Monday, Wednesdays, or is it just traffic?
Oh, you know, I was here at 7.
Good morning, everyone. It's February 16th, and February 22nd, and we're opening the House Economic Development and Trade Committee meeting. Good to see you this morning, and we are going to actually begin somewhat out of order with a work session on House Bill 2243. Which increases the maximum number of zones for electronic commerce, as you may recall. And we're going to open a work session on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2243 extends the sunset of tax credit for electronic commerce zones and enterprise zones or city designated for electronic commerce zones from January 1st, 2018 until January 1st, 2024. It increases the maximum number of allowable enterprise zones from 15 to 21, allows two zones to be designated from January 1st, 2018, January 1st, 2019, and January 1st, 2020, sets the maximum credit allowed in 1 year at $2 million, allows a taxpayer with allowable credit in excess of their tax liability to elect to receive an 80% refund of the tax credit in lieu of any carry forward. Takes effect 91 days after signee die. We do have a revenue and fiscal impact statement on this bill posted to OLIS. And Madam Chair, if you wish to move it, we have all the paperwork.
All right. I will take a motion on that, please.
Madam Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2243. E-commerce zone increase with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 2243 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. Do we just go straight to it? So for people who are watching, the bill will go straight to the Revenue Committee. It won't go to the floor, so we're not going to identify a carrier. But thank you for that. And now we are going to consider introduction of committee bills, please. And we're going to go with that one, but not the second one at this point. First one, not the second one.
Madam Chair, I move that the following committee bill be introduced as a committee bill, and that is LC 3811, dated January 31st, 2017.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves that the following LC be introduced as a committee bill. It's LC 3811, dated January 31st, 2017. And I'm going to ask our committee administrator to briefly describe the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, LC 3811 is a bill dealing with allowing Oregon Liquor Control Commission to create canicultural areas similar to the vinicultural areas related to wine creation. This bill becomes operative on January 1st, 2018 and takes effect on the 91st day following signee die.
So again, this bill, to vote yes on this motion would not signify an intention to vote yes on the merits of the bill itself, but it is generally courtesy to allow bills to be brought in as committee bills. And with that, is there any discussion?
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, I was just kind of curious on behalf of my friend next door to me here, Representative Helm, he was curious as to whether or not this is a carryover from our marijuana committee. I'm just. There you go. You wanted to know.
It is related to marijuana. It's related to the idea that by designating certain areas as known regions, that it might be beneficial to the ability to differentiate between categories. So I'm sure that you have deep knowledge of that.
Thank you.
So, all right. Any further discussion? All right. No, any objections? Seeing none, LC 3811 is introduced as a committee bill, and the motion carries. Now, we are going to open up an informational meeting on Oregon's food industry. We have some wonderful people here today to talk to us about innovations in an economic opportunity in Oregon's food industry. And I'm going to invite now Joel Fisher, Senior Policy Advisor with the Oregon Business Association, and David McKivern, President of Northwest Food Processors Association, to come forward and share with us some perspectives on the food and beverage roadmap process and next steps. Really happy to have you here today. Please start in any order. Start by stating your name for the record.
Bet. Thank you, Chair Leininger. For the record, my name is Joel Fisher, Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Business Association, although I'm not actually senior to anybody there. Should also be noted that I'm here on behalf of Associated Oregon Industries. Our two business associations have merged. That legally happens not until July, but for this session, we have merged our policy agendas. We are working as one organization, and I get to speak on behalf of both of them. So I hope you guys all had a big breakfast because we're going to talk about food for the next little while. And I'm going to give you some background on a project that started probably over 3 years ago. Started as one little boy's dream to combine his passion for food and his love of politics. And that little boy was me. I'm not really at the center of this, but about 3 years ago, you had sort of the coalescence of a lot of members of the Oregon Business Association, Oregon Business Council, Northwest Food Processors Association, coming together and looking at what we can do to accelerate the food industry. And actually, before I get any further, maybe I should let David introduce himself.
Sure. Chair Leininger and committee, it's an honor to be here before you today. Mm-hmm. I'm David McGivern, president of Northwest Food Processors Association, established in 1914 to represent food and beverage manufacturers in the state of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
Great. Thanks again, Joel Fisher with OBA AOI. So we pulled together a large group of people, the key stakeholders, to create this food and beverage roadmap. Northwest Food Processors Association, Oregon Business Association, Oregon State University, Oregon Department of Agriculture, the Oregon Business Council, and Business Oregon. We all got together going back in 2014 to the formation. Top management of 30 companies also joined to form a non-funded volunteer Oregon Food and Beverage Industry Leadership Council. We've testified before, I believe it's this committee, twice. 2015 was where a lot of the work happened, and the governor's office and Business Oregon became more involved. 2016, we raised funds to conduct this, conduct research, create this 10-year roadmap. And then 2017, we finally launched this roadmap on January 9th. So why is this so important? This slide, I think, does a really good job of summing it up. You see here in 2008, follow the black line, there's a large recession. And this is all manufacturing across the United States, or all manufacturing in Oregon, sorry. And we see during the recession it takes a nosedive. But you'll notice that food and beverage manufacturing, the red line, through the recession continues to grow jobs. We coined the term, this industry is recession-proof. Here's another one showing Oregon food and beverage versus all other food and beverage. So food and beverage across the U.S. is holding pretty steady through the recession. And again, Oregon is continuing to add jobs because we've got some comparative advantages. We're doing some things right. We're known for our quality, and we'll get into a little more of that later. So some statistical research highlights. Jobs grew 7.8% between 2007 and 2012. Food and beverage manufacturing supported almost 32,000 direct jobs, with another 4,200 in related distribution, machinery, container manufacturing sectors. Represents $16.4 billion in economic output in 2014, increasing 58.2% in the last 10 years. Creates a significant multiplier effect, supporting 6.1% of the state industry. Oregon ranks second in the nation in the concentration of fruit and vegetable processing. So we came together to create a shared vision, identify competitive advantages and industry needs, develop a business plan for action steps and key investments, establish collaborative public-private partnership, and accelerate actions to address high-impact opportunities. And here's sort of the project process. Phase one was doing this survey and statistical analysis. Phase two is the industry intelligence. We've got a lot of really robust focus groups together. then doing it phase three opportunity analysis, phase four research report and recommendations, and phase five roadmap summary, strategic priorities, and rolling out the implementation plan. So the core objectives, we want actionable outcomes. We want emphasis on 5 to 6 key manufacturing subsectors and identify cross-cutting industry issues. Support short to long-term tactics, so we have some that are pretty immediate and then some stretching out to a 10-year horizon. And then metrics that are tied to growth of the industry and those key subsectors. So here are those key subsectors you see on the top: fruit and vegetables, grains and baking, dairy products, beverages, snacks, coffee, tea, ingredients, mixed food manufacturing, and then these cross-cutting issues. And this is where we can really have that high impact on all of these industries. So the issues we identified are leadership and coordination, research and development and technical assistance, workforce development, distribution infrastructure, market development, and government regulation. So here are the, again, just restating these 5 strategic themes that we are then going to walk through. The R&D, preparing the 21st century workforce, investing in transportation infrastructure, coordinating market development, and collaborating with regulatory resource utilization. So the way that this, the next part of this is set up, I'm going to turn over to David here in a second, is we kind of give just an outline of what is in the roadmap. And so each of these title slides shows you where you can find more information on these. We're just going to cover the high-level bullet points, where you can find them in both the executive summary and the full the executive summary of the roadmap, and then the full roadmap report, which are in OLIS. So I'm going to turn it over to David, and he's going to walk us through sort of this implementation plan and what years of work has resulted in.
Yeah, so thank you, everybody, for giving me a moment to speak with you today and represent the food processing and beverage industry. Just to give you kind of a short background, in 1914, when we were formed out of agricultural groups here in the state of Oregon originally, dryers, canners, fruit and vegetable operations, and then slowly expanded from there into dairy and poultry operations as well as other value-added areas. So the potato salad you eat in July with your families around 4th of July to celebrate, that's made by our members that we represent. The beverages that you drink at night with your meal at a restaurant are produced by members of ours. The meal that was prepared by the chefs were supplied the ingredients by our members. So this touches everybody's life on a daily basis. If we're lucky in this country, we get to eat at least 3 times a day for the most part. It's not the same throughout the rest of the world. Our industry takes it very seriously what they do from a day-to-day basis to not only provide quality ingredients and enhance people's lives, but also in the way that they deliver products globally is very important. I'm sure everyone sits up here and says that their industry is more special than another industry at the end of the day, but I find it hard to believe that there are many that would argue that food is very important and necessary to sustain life. So for us, we take it very personal on how we not only make the product, make sure that it's safe and that it's high quality, but it's delivered to also those that have a very difficult time accessing food on a regular basis. And part of that economically is to make sure that we keep our costs down low and that we have adequate supply of talented individuals from the university system, as well as people that are produced or learn in the university system to come to work for us in our industry. Part of that is R&D research. Within the R&D research infrastructure here in the state of Oregon, we depend very heavily on Oregon State University. Oregon State University for a long time has dedicated not only funding or received funding from private industry, but also from the public to develop out a very strong and nationally recognized food science program, also a very strong engineering programs that we depend upon on a regular basis outside of food science. There are a couple things that the university has done really, really well that I'd like to hit upon today to kind of express our R&D developments that are needed in the state and to expand the and move forward and keep the trajectory of these improvements that we've seen with the economics maps earlier presented by Joel. One is OSU has a couple really deep projects that they're coming up on. One is a fermentation science building. I think they call it a soil-to-shelf program. It's going to focus on dairy and other fermentation sciences. They're going to build a building what I think is important about this program is they're going to attract some of the best scientific minds and professors in the world to want to work within this program. We also have private industry that sees the importance of it and are providing planning to provide private investment towards the building of that. But we also see that the state has an opportunity to invest in order to continue this economic growth. We see it being a future of this state. Secondly, within the R&D category, the extension services that come out of the university system have been very, very important with dealing not only with just agriculture, but with value-added processing as well, and has been instrumental in providing services through the Food Innovation Center, which provides sensory laboratory testing. So is well known in the state, throughout the United States, for companies to come here and to market test their products. Secondly, they have laboratory space that we depend upon for additional research for the industry to tap into from time to time. And these programs are not just important to the learnings of the students and the health of the community, but are very important economically to advancing the food industry and learning more about how they can deliver high-quality products throughout the world globally. There's an expansion and upgrade of OSU facilities of the Soil and Shelf Project, which is projected at $18 million in total investment and $9 million leverage. We're working on developing a business model whereby OSU can work directly with food and beverage companies on proprietary research, leveraging the new facilities that was recognized in the roadmap as being very critical and important. Develop a financially sustainable business model and public-private funding model to expand capacity and scale of services offered at the Food Innovation Center, which you'll hear about more in the next panel. And then expand resources and research capacity to assist firms with food safety issues, particularly additional with microbiologists. As many of you have heard, safety is extremely important. The new Food Safety and Modernization Act is now an act, and food processors are not only complying but figuring out how to overachieve with those issues. We depend upon groups such as the food science programs and Oregon Department of Agriculture in our partnership with the FIC and ensuring that that happens and that takes place here in the state of Oregon, mitigating any sort of branding risks of the products that are produced here. Also, we have issues in our industry moving on to the workforce and talent pipeline issues we're recognizing this roadmap. We've seen a decline in not only interest in working in the industry for some time now, but also skilled and talented labor coming out of our education system as a whole, or the interest for people to want to learn the mechanics of operating a machine or repairing and maintaining these facilities. And so we see this as a giant need for investment, not only at the college level or two-year program level, but also at the K through 12 to build interest in the sciences and maths and also attract them into the importance of being able to help feed the world through working through one of these wonderful food processing facilities here in the state. We can get into more detail later if there are any questions on that, but I'll give you just the overview of the other few items, and then we can I'll hand it over to Joel, and we can dig into those. You know, there are critical investments needed for transportation. I know transportation seems to be a very difficult one to get an understanding and grapple. It's a really big request, but our products, a large percentage of our products move out of the state, which is great for the state economy. But at the same time, we need dependable infrastructure, roads, and rail in order to ship these products east of Oregon, east of the Cascades on a regular basis, also to ship them through containers over to the Pacific Rim, which we have many wonderful partners there that purchase those products. So we are very encouraged by where we could be if we had a great transportation package. So we see that being a huge critical priority of our roadmap. Also, we see that the streamlining of government regulations is really important for the industry. We have a lot of new growth, new companies coming on board, people that have this wonderful formulation of a salsa. I'm sure many of you have had your grandma's salsa or a product and thought, you know, if I could just bottle this and share it with the world, it'd be wonderful. Our state is very encouraging of this type of innovation and entrepreneurism. And within that spirit of entrepreneurism, it's critical that we have people that can help answer the regulatory questions to these new entrepreneurs, as well as existing organizations. There seems to be a lot of duplication between permits, between states, the state, county, cities. Also, it seems to be some confusion around where people can go for additional resources to work with the state on site planning and the specifications needed in order to build a proper facility to ensure that they can be on board on time with their product lines and not hold up some of the key accounts that they promised product to. So we see working as an association, as a council, working with groups like AOI as well as other agricultural associations in the state and figuring out what is the best way to create a single source of information for these folks so it becomes much easier for them to create new businesses as well as continue to grow the existing businesses. Outside of that, I don't have too much more to offer besides being able to answer some questions. And Joel, I'd like to hand it over to you.
Yeah, so the last slide here basically sums up all the bullet points we went through just on one page for you. The other thing I would highlight around workforce is that the opportunity here is to have Oregon really branded as a place where people can come for these jobs, right? We are known as, if you want a job in the retail industry, we've got Nike, we've got Adidas, we've got Under Armour. People know that they can come here and have a secure career at one of these companies, and if it doesn't work out at one, going to another. And we are encouraged to see the same thing starting to happen with people coming here for a job with maybe Dave's Killer Bread and moving on to Tillamook or something like that. So branding ourselves as the place to be for food and beverage. With that, we'd like to take any questions.
Committee, do we have any? Yes, Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for coming today. On the R&D that you talked about, your first point, does the industry pay for this R&D? Do they pay partial amount, or is it just sourcing through the university and then you leverage the research and development done there?
So I'd like to break the R&D down into a couple different areas. There's kind of your basic research, mm-hmm. right, the university conducts to learn and create new discoveries as a whole. And then eventually the industry sees that and says, that's important to us. On the other end, there are common issues among the industry where they need a support and infrastructure in place to be able to supply them with really good information on little bad bugs that could harm you if it were to get into your food supply, for instance. That's important for the community as well as the business as well as university research. So on one end, the industry will supply funding in order to work on these common issues as a whole. On the other end, we'll work with helping identify areas of basic research where there may be some trends occurring globally where they'd like to learn more, and the university may be best situated to be able to share that risk or as a whole with the community.
So it's a mix.
It's a mix, okay. Of course. Yeah.
Thank you.
Additional questions for this panel? Well, I'd like to make a comment. I think that the work that you've done through the Food and Beverage Roadmap process is really important. You know, as we look for ways to spur job creation all around the state and create economic opportunity all around the state, it's smart to look at things that we are world-class good at and how we can expand the opportunity and the vitality of those sectors. And it's certainly the case that in our food and beverage sector, you know, Tillamook Cheese, Dave's Killer Bread, Bob's Red Mill, and then our wine and beer and cider and distilled spirits sectors, all of those things are things that we have world-class potential to be a player in. And in some sectors, we already are. They start with rural agriculture, involve value-added processing that can happen in the rural parts of the state or in urban areas, and then traded sector sales. So it's kind of, checks all of the boxes of things that we, as people who care about economic vitality all around the state, care about. And in many of these companies, there's a strong sustainability component too. And so, you know, for folks who see that as an important value, it aligns very much with Oregon culture too. So, you know, it's a tough economic cycle, but I am hopeful that we'll be able to endorse investments in some opportunities to expand Oregon's capacity, you know, at the university level, at the Food Innovation Center level, to continue growing these sectors. And I really appreciate your teamwork in coming up with ideas would actually be helpful and coming on behalf of the group that you've worked with to present them to us today. And Rep. Rashke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other question I had was about, you mentioned that it was recession-proof. During the recession, it looked like it kind of grew a little bit, and then it's taken off again, the industry. Do you have data where that's happening in the state? I mean, is it all around Portland? Is it all around Bend in the microbrew world? Is it, where is that happening, and where are some opportunities for it to grow further, or is it just a statewide phenomenon? And if you don't have that here, if you get it to me later.
We don't have the details in front of us.
Yeah.
We do have the report, but the details, we want to make sure that we're providing accurate information so you make
sure,
good decisions.
That's fine.
But overall, we're getting very well-rounded in terms of the rural communities as well as west of the Cascades. I would say that's not just Portland as a hub or Salem as a hub, but also you've got Bend that has huge food growth. And you have fairly large facilities that are working on investment and expanding their facilities. So in one instance, you may have one company that expands to 200 jobs. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you may have an attractiveness to produce food through an entrepreneurial moral program. And you maybe have 20 to 30 companies with 10 new employees, for instance, each over a 18-month period. So the retail sector has done some really neat things to help attract this. One is they've kind of removed the barrier of entry of getting products on the shelf and kind of providing that promotional opportunity to those products. New Seasons is a great example of that. And so they bring in a lot of new products and food, and then all of a sudden this interest is created, and then you have these small young entrepreneurs that look at it and say, wow, I really got something viable here. Then they go after investments, and they attract investments from outside the state as well as inside the state in order to expand that opportunity. So it's kind of all over the board, but we can definitely parse out the specifics of that question and provide that to you in written form after this hearing.
That'd be great. And in your presentation, tell that story, the one of New Seasons, and how it all, rather than being just all theory and numbers, give specific examples, because that's a great example of how this works. Thank you.
Thanks. And I would also note that, you know, Tillamook Creamery and Pacific Seafood are both businesses that affect, you know, coastal opportunity in a really tremendous way. And Rep. Brocksmith was noting one additional that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. BC Fisheries down in the Port of Brookings Harbor is, I think, employing up to 37 folks. And it's a great, clean operation. They're doing great work down there in a depressed economy. So much needed.
So the food and beverage sector isn't the silver bullet that solves every single economic opportunity issue that we have in Oregon, but it is a crucial part of a successful, widely dispersed set of opportunities. So thank you, and we look forward to hearing more from you and others as we move forward in this.
Did they bring any samples? That's what I was wondering. I mean, we're talking
people
about
always ask that in the cannabis
beverages.
Meetings too.
All right, just asking.
Thank you. All right. Thanks so much, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Okay. And now we will invite forward. We will invite forward David Stone, Director of the Food Innovation Center, and Dan Arp, Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University, to talk about some investment opportunities and ways in which you are supporting the opportunity for increased jobs and economic vitality. Welcome, and please begin in any order. State your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Dave Stone. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Food Science and Technology at Oregon State University and the director of the Food Innovation Center.
Good morning. I'm Dan Arp, Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University. Thank you.
Great.
And then again, for the record, David McGivern, President of Northwest Food Processors Association.
Wonderful.
Okay. Well, Chair Leininger, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share the good work that the Food Innovation Center is doing at this meeting this morning. I'll give a brief background of the history of the FIC and our mission, and talk about the impact we've had with Oregon entrepreneurs and companies across the state. We've opened in 1999, And we're in the Pearl District. And it was a very different Pearl District back then, so the building actually served as an anchor building for some of the redevelopment that you see now. And I doubt OSU could afford the 1.5 acres that we're on today. But it's a great location. We're close to PDX. We're close to a lot of the Central East Side and other food processing and entrepreneurial activity in the metro area. But I want to emphasize, even though we're in Portland, we are an Oregon station. We're here for all of Oregon, and we work with all of Oregon on a variety of different commodities. We are a joint venture between OSU and the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I'll talk a little bit more about that because that has a lot of great synergy in the collaborations that we have together and the services we can provide for entrepreneurs in the industry. Our services are client-oriented. We do research, we do teach, we do workshops, but the work we do and the equipment we have and the facilities that we've designed are there for the food industry. And we've supported thousands of Oregon entrepreneurs and companies, and I'll give examples of that. Our mission is to provide technical, creative, and educational services to the food industry, entrepreneurs, and Northwest communities. And our focus is on quality, safety, and sustainability. And so I was really happy to hear all those themes already come out because I think this is Brand Oregon, and this is the opportunities we have around food and beverage to even further our reach and our market access. Those first tier of services up there are the things that I'll talk about with subsequent slides, and that is product and process development, food safety and training, and sensory and consumer testing. But I'd also like to emphasize that we do market analysis, and that is kind of consumer choice models and consumers' willingness to pay for products, extension and outreach, student and adult training, so we are creating the next leaders, helping to create the next leaders in the food and beverage industry, and then research, both basic but primarily applied and service to the profession. In our product and process development services, and apologize again if you are hungry, some of these pictures probably won't help with that. We do have a pilot plant incubator that we help a lot of entrepreneurs, both domestic and now international, come and incubate in and help develop their products further and help to get their products out to retail and to market and get licensed. We have a commercial kitchen. We help with product ideation, and I'll give an example of that with Bob's Red Mill, and a consultation that we work with entrepreneurs on a daily basis. We're very hands-on. We're very client-oriented. It's a very personal, intimate experience when you come work with us. We help source ingredients so that we're looking at what does Oregon provide, who are the farmers, what are the capacity, you know, because we grow some of the best stuff in the world, and we're trying to help people source from Oregon. We can help reformulate products. The millennials are asking for something different in their food, and we can help companies make sure they're at the forefront of that trend, so they're providing that. Food safety testing, we can help with package engineering, shelf life testing, and market analysis. And the example I'd like to give here is from Matt Cox, a VP of marketing, and basically they came to us with needing help on developing a convenient single-serve item for their oatmeal, a cup to go. And so we helped develop this concept. We helped them with the packaging, with the formulation of it, the food safety testing. And so I asked him if he can get me some numbers. And this product now has reached $6.5 million of revenue for Bob's Red Mill in Oregon. They keep breaking new records every month with this product. And we feel like we've been a really helpful partner in getting this out. I did purchase samples of this over the weekend to share with the committee. My two teenage boys ate them already, so I apologize for that. I intended to bring some. In addition to product development, we also do sensory and consumer testing. Consumer acceptability is absolute key to value and success in the marketplace. And so our sensory scientists and economic scientists help provide valuable market data to companies. And this data allows them to avoid costly mistakes. So they know what the consumer is looking for and wants by the time it reaches that new seasons or that other retail shelf. And those are very familiar companies, I'm sure, to all of us here, of some of the Oregon clients that we've worked with to help them get that product down to what's not only going to be acceptable to Oregonians, but then their broader markets that they reach into as well, either domestically or internationally. Food safety research, obviously food safety is paramount, and it's taken on more and more importance, not only nationally, but globally. In part thanks to a Western Regional Center to Enhance Food Safety grant, but also additional support to the OSU statewides, we were able to hire a new tenure-track food safety expert, Dr. Jovana Kovacevic, who's an expert in Listeria, a very important pathogen to all the industries in food. We are remodeling a state-of-the-art food safety laboratory. And a big role that she will play, along with some other staff, will be to help train and implement the Food Safety Modernization Act. This far-reaching, expansive federal law will impact Oregon. And the dates that for the mid-sized processors for compliance are this September, and small processors are next September. It will also affect farmers. And so we want to make sure we have the clarity around that law, we have the ways that that people are appropriately trained, and they're ready to address it. Our significant partner and joint venture around the Food Innovation Center is the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We interact very closely with the Ag Development and Marketing Team, and upstairs is the Oregon Department of ODA Laboratory Services, which does a lot of important testing on pesticide residues, microbial analysis, shellfish toxins, certification, and inspection. And, you know, some of the examples I could give, many of the collaborations we do with ODA include promotion of Oregon agriculture and value-added development of those products, coordination of food safety training across the Pacific Northwest, and exploring and opening new markets for Oregon products, both domestically and internationally. And I'll end with something I think we all know, that food connects Oregon. Connects rural and urban Oregon in a major way, and it is a conversation point, is an economic incubator for both rural and urban Oregon, and brings people together. Branch experiment stations like the FIC can help connect cultural and spatial distances within Oregon, particularly around food and many of the issues that OSU works on. So thank you for your time and being able to share the work of the FIC, and please visit if you haven't already.
It is a great, it's a tremendous facility to visit. So if you haven't been there, they give a wonderful tour, and it helps show some really remarkable services that support creation of new food entrepreneurs in the state.
Thank you.
If I can just add to that. As a former county commissioner, we do what's called County College, and that's part of our education, if you will, is the touring of that facility at OSU. And so it's been, you're doing great work. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Leininger, committee members, thank you for the opportunity here. Presentations coming up. I think what you'll find is that much of what I have to say has already been presented in one way or another. So some of what I have I can go through fairly briefly, and that'll give me a chance to focus on some of the things that haven't been said yet. So I'm here to talk about what we call our Oregon Quality Food and Beverage Initiative. So this is an initiative that we started 2 or 3 years ago in the College of Ag Sciences at Oregon State University, which really complements the efforts that you've been hearing about here, and in particular complements the roadmap effort that you heard about from Joel and Dave this morning. So, Dave, can you? Yeah, thanks. So I wanted to sort of set the stage for you first. So this interest in food, Oregonians, as you know, are passionate about their food and beverages, and they show that in many different ways. They expect their foods and beverages to be of high quality, meaning the flavor, but also the nutritional value, the safety, all aspects of it. And they're willing to pay for it. They also expect them to be sustainably produced, and we see that again in many different ways across the state. To the extent possible, they like to see that these are produced in the state of Oregon or at least in the Pacific Northwest. Not exclusively, but many things they like to see produced there. This interest in food that we're talking about, what I want to do is broaden the discussion just a little bit to remind us that the base of that is agriculture. So in Oregon, we're fortunate to have an incredibly diverse agricultural system that does support the emphasis on food that we're talking about. For example, we have over 200 different commodities raised in the state of Oregon that we're second only to California in terms of the diversity of the agricultural commodities that we produce in the state. And we do it in all different types of production systems. So we have organic to conventional, we have small farms all the way to very large farms. So all these work together in the state of Oregon. And the food and beverage industry that we're talking about here really builds on this diversity of agricultural production in the state. Together, the food and beverage and the agricultural industry have a tremendous impact on Oregon's economy. So Dave, next slide. Again, you've seen this already, so I can go very quickly through this. In fact, I will just remind you that this is from the Food and Beverage Roadmap, Strong Economic Impact of Food and Beverage on the State's Economy. Next slide. This is another slide that's included in the roadmap. This gets a little more in detail. What I really wanted to pick up with this slide is simply to remind you that when you take the food and beverage and then include the agricultural components, the numbers get even larger in terms of the impact on Oregon's economy. This particular slide also includes the fiber aspect of the agricultural and food industries. So you put all those pieces together, and it's 13.2% of the output sales in Oregon, and about the same percentage in terms of the jobs that are provided to the Oregon economy through agriculture and the food work that's done. So very large numbers indeed. Within the College of Ag Sciences, so what is our role at Oregon State University in supporting then this food and beverage industry? And again, want to emphasize that while the discussions of the first three were about the food and beverage, we start with the soils and then carry that theme all the way through to the foods and beverages that find their way onto the shelf. So we talk about our soil to shelf coverage of the work in the college. We have a statewide footprint. So Dave talked about the Food Innovation Center, which is one of our branch experiment stations in Portland. We have 13 branch experiment stations distributed across the state. We also have the work that goes on in Corvallis, and we have other fields stations across the state as well. We contribute to research and development. Dave did a very nice job of talking about the work that we do in terms of providing the research that supports that industry at the basic level right through to the individual company that needs help with a particular research problem that they're working on developing. We're also there to develop skilled workforce. So we provide the students who get the degrees, who end up working for many of these Oregon companies in support of the food and beverage industry. And of course, we're there doing outreach and extension to make sure that the work that we do in the university gets to the end users, and that we're also hearing from the end users about what their needs are. Dave, next slide. Just wanted to make it clear that this quality food and beverage initiative that we have at Oregon State University is well integrated with the roadmap that you heard about from Joel and David. So this really just reviews what you've already heard. What I just want to do is drop down to the very last set of bullets and the roadmap that has the five areas. Two of those areas we're really deeply involved in at Oregon State University, the research and development component and the skilled workforce. So we've been working closely together, and these two initiatives really work hand in hand. Next slide. Wanted to talk then about what we need from the legislature, our request to the legislature, in order to make this work. First of all, this is a part of the Oregon State University statewide. So this includes the Agricultural Experiment Station, the Extension Service, and the Forest Research Laboratories. And our request is to maintain the statewides at their continuing service levels. So that's what we need to be able to do this. The map of Oregon on the upper right-hand corner there shows you statewide presence, just to reinforce that. Each of those dots actually represents an individual who was hired in the last 2 years as a result of the increased support that we received from the legislature 2 years ago. So those are the people and where they are. And somewhere up there, I think you see Ivana's dot. Is that right?
That's yeah. Right.
Okay. The other request that we have of the legislature is support for a building project, a capital project we're calling the Fermentation Sciences Education and Research Center, which is really the centerpiece of the Oregon Quality Food and Beverage Initiative. This is an $18 million facility. We're asking for $9 million from revenue bonds from the state, and we'll match that with industry and private support. And we've secured our first lead gift of $1.5 million towards that building from Tillamook, and have outstanding gift solicitations from a number of other companies as well. Just wanted to give you an idea what this building will look like. It's a 26,000 square foot facility. It'll have three pilot plants. One will focus on dairy products, one on beer, cider, and distilled spirits, and the third one will focus on wine. There'll be a classroom, a storefront, where you can come and purchase the Beaver Classic cheese and other products that you're interested in. There'll be an analytical laboratory, walk-in temperature chambers, and then an offices and conference room as well. Here's what it looks like as a floor plan. And basically, you see the three large rectangles at the bottom. Those are the three pilot plants, so they're the largest part of the facility. They almost a little over half of the usable space, in fact, is those pilot plants. And then also the other parts of the facility that I mentioned, the the cold rooms, the classroom, the analytical laboratory. Next slide gives us an architect's rendering of this building, so you can get a sense of what it would look like. This is the front-facing view of the building, so you can see the tall parts of the three pilot plants in the building. And so that hopefully gives you an idea of the facility that we're hoping to be able to start construction on in the next couple of years as we secure the funds from the state and from private and industry donations. The last slide, So what this center will enable us to do, and again, David's really already mentioned this, it allows these enhanced partnerships with our industry partners. So we'll be able to do that basic research that David talked about, but also work more closely with the industry partners on their research and development projects. It also creates much greater opportunities for our students. We're very focused on hands-on learning, experiential learning, we call it, and this will improve the opportunities for that. It also helps us to better carry these projects from soil to shelf. So as the projects that we have, a good example of that is as we look at wine research and tonnage research, it's not enough to stop at measuring the tonnage that we get from the vineyards. You need to carry that on to wine production to know the quality of the wines that you make as well. So, and this facility will help us to carry that research from soil to shelf. And of course, it also will provide us with more instrumentation and space to do the research and teaching that we do. So on the last slide, then, I do want to point out that we're not focused entirely on the building. That's the centerpiece for now, but we have other things going on and also future plans as well. So certainly, we are interested in developing business education opportunities for students. We're working with the new dean of the College of Business to create some additional opportunities. Dave's already talked about the Food Innovation Center. We do see additional opportunities to build out the Food Innovation Center, both in terms of its programs and in terms of the physical space. We are interested in eventually developing additional modules, additional pilot plants that would just continue the theme that you saw of that building. Certainly fruit and vegetable processing is an important one, and meat processing is another one that we'd very much like to do in the future. And we do have an experimental vineyard called Woodhall, and we're currently making some enhancements to that as well. So hopefully that gives you some sense of the Oregon Quality Food and Beverage Initiative and the work that we're doing at Oregon State University in support of the food and beverage industry in Oregon. So thank you for your time. Be happy to answer any questions.
That's wonderful. Rep Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for coming. Where is this fermentation plant going to be built, in Klamath or Lake County? I might have eight other. I'm serious about that. Was a shameless plug, but serious about where is it going to be built?
Yeah, so this will be located on the Corvallis campus.
Okay,
and if you know where the Oldfield Animal Teaching Facility is, a rather new facility there, it will be just across the street from that.
Okay, thank you.
Wonderful.
You know, Madam Chair, I'm really proud of what you guys are doing. It's fun to listen to this. So great job.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have to agree. First, a quick disclaimer that while the Tillamook Creamery is in Debbie Boone's district, the cows are all in my district. That's an important distinction to make. But Oregon State has a long and rich history of supporting our food industry and doing remarkable work there. I'm reminded of my time on campus when they developed both the maraschino cherry and the flea collar, which I think came out of the same actual lab. But good work being done, and I'd just like to see it move forward.
Thank you.
Yes, Rep. Rocksmith, and then Rep.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm excited as a South Coast representative of the bacon seaweed. Because everything's better with bacon, but it's going to take the calories out.
There you go. Rep.
Madam Chair, I can't resist. The bacon seaweed actually came out of my district at the Hatfield Marine Science Center. I think what's most interesting about the Dulce product is not only seaweed that tastes like bacon, it's also being used for a variety of products, which include cattle feed, and that feeding cattle this seaweed product will reduce their methane output by 80%.
Wow, that's a miracle indeed.
Can I get a follow-up?
Well, yes, sure. I don't want to step
into
that.
So at the new OSU Extension facility in Port Orford, which is where they are actually growing the
Dulce,
the seaweed as we speak. The Dulce.
I'm going to go duck football here in a minute.
All right, Rep. Clem.
Do you, John, know which county produces the most agricultural products in the whole state?
In terms of dollar amount?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
Tell me.
Marion County.
Oh, guess which two legislators are from Marion County? Sorry, everybody.
Well, Lynn's got to be awful dang close, doesn't it?
Not even really.
Not at all. Yeah, I'm wearing it down shoelace level.
So that's excellent. And if you had follow-up comments, I want to give you a chance to make those too. But I want to note that I think everyone on this committee currently lives in or grew up in a part of the state that has been affected by transitions in our economy, in our natural resource economy, and that would really benefit from invigoration of agricultural production and processing and sales opportunities of the type that you and your predecessors were talking about today on the panel. So this is exciting, and I think, you know, an important piece of work that this committee could do during the legislative session would be to robustly endorse the support requests that you have that go down to Ways and Means. I don't know if that looks like us putting forward a bill that we could endorse and that it gets referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. So it's not going to move across the floor because the determination really happens Ways and Means. But I think that we could signal our strong support and prioritization for some of these investments, and we should talk about ways that we can do that as a committee, because this is some great opportunity that you're describing. I have a really long note from Representative Brock Smith that I'm going to read later. He's so great to sit next to, I have to say.
I doubt that. I'm always pestering her.
No, it's great. All right, did you have additional comments you'd like to make?
Maybe 30 seconds.
Please.
Can you hear just fine?
Yes, I think so. Start with your name again, please.
Yeah, David McGivern, Northwest Food Processors Association president. These are more than just buildings. These are buildings that attract investment into the state. Although OSU has done an incredible job and they have great existing infrastructure, there are other communities throughout the country that are investing in food, and they have done so for some time. And we want to make sure that OSU not only maintains current service levels, but they become the poster child and the lead in this effort. Instead of companies here in the state going out of state for R&D development, there's no reason why we shouldn't keep it here. And as you saw earlier with the charts that Joel had presented to the committee, I'd invest in a racehorse that is in the lead. You know, an economy or an industry that is actually excel during a recession is a great investment across the board. And I think it's great not only for the students in the community, but also for the businesses that have been investing here for some time, but also attracts other companies to come here and do business in this state. So with that, I'm in full support. The industry is in full support of what's being proposed by the OSU here, as well as the FIC's extension program out of OSU, and then the industry roadmap that was developed that we were part of. So with that, we ask for your support, and we thank you for allowing us to be here today to present to you. Thank you.
Great. Thanks a lot. I actually want to highlight one more thing. I think when I came down to OSU to take a tour, we learned that right now, because of the relatively modest infrastructure that you have for that really important program, some of our food and beverage processors have to use UC Irvine or Cornell-based or Colorado-based R&D facilities. And so we're leaving money and jobs on the table that should be by right in Oregon. Can you speak to that for a second so that folks can get the benefit of that?
Yeah, there's no question that the size of our facilities now and the state of the facilities limit what we can do in terms of reaching out and doing that kind of R&D for companies. You mentioned a number of universities. They're also reaching out to private companies to do some of that research. We would like to keep that work in state and work with our industry partners to help them do that. And that's some of the new work that again, David mentioned that we're looking towards, is how we can enhance those university industry partnerships and be that local partner so that companies don't have to leave the state in order to do that work.
Excellent. Yes, Rep. Marsh.
I just wanted to make a comment. I represent a large swath of Jackson County, other end of the state, and which, in which we have certainly a very strong and continuing to develop agricultural and value-added food industry. And just a sort of an indication of how appreciated the services of OSU are in the community, Jackson County actually voted a tax levy to support our extension center. And I think that's really notable because it's really a reflection of the focus our local communities have on the services that come out of these centers. And I think it's a strong message to us at the state level that these are, you know, there's nothing like putting your money out to indicate it, the value that you see.
Yeah.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Okay, thank you again very much. And now we are going to invite up the representative of another part of the agricultural production sector at which Oregon is world-class accomplished. We're going to have Bo Whitney from Whitney Economics come forward, please, to discuss the cannabis industry in Oregon. And three of the committee members have been discussing almost nothing but cannabis for the last 3 years as we serve on the Joint Marijuana Regulation Committee. But this legislative session, one of the things that we're trying to do is expand the knowledge base among members of the legislature in terms of how economically significant the sector is, what the level of job creation is, and Mr. Whitney, who is an economist, has been doing some research into that, and he's here today to share with us a little bit of that information. I think you'll find it really interesting. Thank you. Please state your name for the record, and thank
Chair,
you for being here.
Members of the committee, my name is Bo Whitney from Whitney Economics. There's been a lot of interest in jobs and economic impact associated with the cannabis industry, not only in Oregon but across the country. Some estimates in terms of total jobs across the country are about 123,000. I think that number is actually low, but there's not really a whole lot of data out there in order to ascertain how many jobs there are. So in doing a preliminary analysis on the job impact in Oregon specifically, I reached out to organizations such as the Department of Employment, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and the Oregon Health Authority. So today I thought I'd present some of the initial findings of my investigation, and then I thought I would supplement that later on in the year with a more detailed, robust, comprehensive job report and economic impact. Currently in Oregon, there's roughly 1,200 businesses associated with cannabis, a majority of which have been licensed through the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, slightly over 900, and then a couple of hundred medical dispensaries that are regulated by the Oregon Health Authority. That represents roughly 12,500 jobs in Oregon. And that, to me, was a surprising number. I thought there would be 4,000 or 5,000, but there's actually significantly more than that. And I think this is a very, very conservative estimate. In terms of annual wages that this represents, it's roughly $315 million in wages. So a pretty significant contribution to the Oregon economy, with a multiplier that would be approximately $1.2 billion in economic activity. So a lot of people underestimate the impact that the cannabis industry has in Oregon, but with data like this, it's obvious that the cannabis industry is a significant player, especially in agriculture, but in the Oregon economy as a whole. Like I said, the information is difficult to obtain and really nail down. For example, when I met with the employment department, they actually categorize cannabis businesses by their name. And so if there was Acme Company, then that would not be categorized as a cannabis business. But if there was Buds 101 or Buds R Us, then just by the name alone, they would categorize that as a cannabis business. So there's an area of opportunity to increase the data and the data sources for this, but it's going to have to also be changed at the federal level. because a lot of these categorizations are from the North America Industrial Classification System. And so that's a North American treaty and something that the federal government would have to change before we would get comprehensive detailed data in Oregon. I was recently in Washington, D.C., meeting on cannabis taxation just last Friday, and the Congressional Research Office was looking for data, and they were looking for reform in the system and data gathering, and so they're very receptive towards this type of change. The majority of the jobs that the methodology that I used in gathering this data, I looked at the marijuana handler permits because that's a pretty good indicator on a person who has a job in this space, and it's required by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to have a permit to do anything in adult use cannabis jobs or businesses. And so there's currently roughly 12,000 applicants for food handlers, for marijuana handlers cards. Given the fact that these are relatively low-paying jobs, a person is not going to plunk down $100 to get their card on the hopes of getting a job. There's more of an economic incentive once they have the job or offer. In addition to these numbers, I added in some jobs associated with the medical industry, but that is slowly being wound down, and so there will be fewer and fewer opportunities in the medical space and more opportunities in the adult use space. Like I said earlier, I think that these numbers, once we have a more comprehensive analysis of the total market, the wages and jobs associated with the cannabis industry in Oregon will be significantly higher. But this is the initial, investigation, and I just wanted to share the results.
Thank you. Rep. Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to see you, Bo. And thanks for this. For the committee's benefit, I think, understand that Bo's sort of on the cutting edge of tracking the economic impacts of the cannabis industry, not just here, but probably nationally. I think for some of the committee members that are not as familiar as the three of us with the raw numbers and potential for the cannabis industry nationally, the committee could benefit by some of the national numbers and national trends that you see in overall market growth in the near future to understand where we fit as a state in that national market.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Helm, thank you for the question. On a national basis, the total market for cannabis from a demand perspective is $50 billion.
May I jump in? Is that the regulated market only, or is that sort of the whole market, both
the total,
illicit
and regulated? The current regulated market is approximately $6 billion, and so there's $44 billion of opportunity there. On a national basis, 29 states, including Washington, D.C., have legalized in some form on the medical side or the recreational or adult use side. There's significant, opportunity here. So some other statistics. Oregon's market currently, I've calculated at $850 million of total market, 550 which will be supported through the regulated system. So there's additional growth opportunity. The five-year cumulative growth rate across the country is about 25%. In Oregon, it's been much higher because we just introduced the recreational program. So the growth rate year over year was about 50%. But it'll slowly decline as the market matures. There's plenty of opportunity here. In some states where they introduce adult use, 100% year-over-year growth, significant contributions to the economy. So the market is somewhat underestimated, but the market potential there is significant.
Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Rep. Marsh.
Almost every, thank you, Chair Leininger. Almost every hearing that I sit through these days, I hear a complaint from industry about workforce issues. You having any trouble finding workforce in the cannabis industry?
Madam Chair, Representative March, a lot of the jobs are say in the $12 to $15 an hour range. And so in that aspect, there's not a lot of, you know, specialization that occurs. But once you get into more of the value-added processes for, like, refinement, production, even on wholesale, then there's a skill set that is difficult to obtain good quality people, for example, a chemist. In some aspects, there is a shortage of labor on those specialized positions, but then on the average, you know, manual labor, then those are pretty readily available.
Rep. Brocksmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So talking about workforce, let's talk about housing. My understanding is you have, you know, all these, you know, increased labor, but in counties such as Josephine and Jackson and others, there isn't the housing. Because the growing, of course, is fairly labor-intensive, and, of course, so is the processing. But, again, there isn't the housing for these folks to live.
Representative Leininger, Representative Brocksmith, I haven't really necessarily looked into the housing associated with it. I could include that in, you know, the more enhanced investigation that I do, but I thought I would primarily look at jobs directly associated with the touching of the plants and touching of the product, and then expand out beyond that. And so this analysis was mainly on only jobs that touch the product and touch cannabis. It doesn't include real estate, accounting, security, or any of those auxiliary positions.
Thank you. And those are, that is a pretty big sector, how it's affected the real estate sector, how it's affected things like security and legal and communications and marketing. I want to flag for the committee that one of the areas of opportunity that we've heard about quite a bit in the Marijuana Regulation Committee that we're going to start kind of exporting into this committee as we disperse the work of the Marijuana Committee to various subject matter committees over the next year and going forward, is cannabis tourism. Now, I know in Representative Marsh's district, and that's where I grew up and have a lot of family, that the wine tourism sector is a really big deal, and the cannabis production sector is a really big deal, too. And I think, you know, some of the opportunities that people see for this legal sector and job growth are trying to create the opportunity for cannabis tourism that is appropriate and somewhat similar to the really thriving viticulture tourism sector that we have and food tourism sector that are growing. And so some bills that we're going to be talking about in the committee, though they have not been referred to our committee for consideration, but we want to talk about in concept, are some of the social consumption bills. So those have to do with the fact that now you'll have tourists come in from out of town, and they ask their cab drivers or their restaurateurs or their hoteliers, where can we go to? We want to check out this sector. Where can we go to experience it or consume? And there actually aren't places you can legally go. And so it raises interesting questions. We, of course, have the Indoor Clean Air Act, and we have a bunch of people who have some concerns about the pace with which we roll out this legal market in general. But I think there are interesting questions to consider this year and in years to come about how we address the needs of the, you know, just kind of opportunities within the sector in a responsible way. So that's just a heads up that we're going to talk about that more. And thank you, Mr. Whitney, for your presentation. Any other questions for Mr. Whitney? All right.
I might add on the
please.
On the can of tourism, a lot of the data that we put together in the industry and as analysts, we don't include canna tourism. We include just the indigenous demand within the state. But canna tourism is a significant factor in Increasing the opportunity within a state. Social consumption is, I'm currently collaborating on a book that covers the entire United States. And one of the common issues amongst different states is canna tourism and social consumption. Colorado's debating it. Alaska's debating it, Washington. So, assuming that there is a place to go, and there's also another social impact on that for people that don't have any other place to go, but assuming that that nut can be cracked, there'll be additional growth in the cannabis industry just on canna tourism and social consumption.
Right. Thank you. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. And we're going to close this informational hearing on the food industry, which included the cannabis sector, which makes edibles, but also other things. And now we're going to open a couple of public hearings. The first is going to be on House Bill. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2041. Both of these hearings that we're about to have are on concepts that we're not planning to try to work today, but are part of a conversation about ways that this committee can potentially take action to support expansion of job opportunities in the food beverage sector. So with that, Mr. Crawford, could you describe House Bill 2041?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2041 establishes the Certified Oregon Program within the Oregon Business Development Department to certify for-profit and nonprofit businesses to use the term Certified Oregon when advertising, creates the Certified Oregon Advisory Group to advise and make recommendations to Business Oregon to implement the program to certify businesses, specifies the advisory group membership, requires Business Oregon and the advisory group to report to the Legislative Assembly on or before September 15, 2019, regarding the implementation of the program.
Thank you. And we have Joel Fisher signed up to provide testimony. Would you like to? And then Representative Klum, would you like to give some framing remarks on this?
Can I go down?
Please do. Yeah. And we're going to have Representative Klum lead us off there. Thank you. This is a great bill for discussion purposes, and I'm interested in hearing more about the genesis of the idea and ways in which it might be something for us to work with.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Klum, State Representative from District 21, which is here in Salem. And I'll let Joel talk about his genesis for his version of Certified Oregon. I'll talk about mine. I do want to note that this is one of the few remaining Klum-Gilliam bills that you'll get to see, because I don't know that the rest of the bills I haven't dropped yet with his name, they will allow to print his name. But this one still has our names on it, so I'm very proud of that fact. So the concept, for me at least, came from work I was doing overseas internationally for about 8 years now, including spending as much as 3 months of each year in Asia selling American-made products, typically Oregon-made. And one thing I noticed was bigger entities like Nike and Columbia in particular have huge presence in Asia through their brand. And you go to lots of little places in Indonesia and malls on the outskirts of Hong Kong by the airport, and you see Nike and Columbia. What you don't typically see is the word Oregon ever anywhere. And people in China in particular have heard of Nike and Columbia, and then you can kind of identify what province, because they don't really call them states, what province you're from by saying, where were Nike's from? Oh, great. And then they know. They may have heard of the Portland Trailblazers because NBA shows on TV in China. But really, unless you say Nike, Columbia, or Portland Trailblazer, they don't know what Oregon is. They don't even use the word Oregon, actually. It's like Oregonzo is the – he speaks Mandarin. He can get the right phonetic piece. So I started thinking about what it would take to get bigger entities like Nike and Columbia to talk about where they're headquartered in their packaging. Obviously, no mandate's going to work. So how do you coax them into acknowledging their homeland, Oregon? Because there's a huge consumer market out there that other states and countries have had a lot more success branding their regions. So I'll give you an example. Champagne. Champagne is a region in France that has co-opted the term Champagne because it's their region, and they have protocols in their legal system and in international protocols that you can't use the word Champagne unless you're from Champagne. Huge value. It takes your sparkling wine from $4 a bottle up to about $75 a bottle in every bar in Taipei. And that's the kind of concept that I started thinking about. Is Oregon... I think it is, but is Oregon such a special place that we could brand Oregon in and of itself? Now, companies who have huge marketing budgets are already doing this on their own. So, you know, Tillamook and Pacific Foods and others, they wouldn't ever choose to have Certified Oregon be their exclusive brand. But for the bigger ones, could you convince them to at least put it somewhere on the box by having it be meaningful? That was my concept. For smaller companies, I will tell you that we typically don't have the budgets to brand our own products in the way that you would want to get actual consumer awareness. And so, for example, our orchard is technically called Suzuki Tambara. You would never know that because we don't put it on any product. We're part of Diamond Fruit Growers. If you go to Costco, you'll see our pears. They're not called Diamond Fruit Growers either. They're called Northwest Pears. So people try to band together to pool their money to pick a brand in this state pretty commonly when they're not big enough to make their own brand. Well, I would love to be able to market something other than Northwest pears because I'm pretty proud of Oregon. I don't really want to market Washington pears, to be honest. But you know what? Our marketing commodity commission's figured out that we don't have enough money to do our own Oregon branding to the point of hitting consumer saturation. Let me give you another example. California was branding its wine in China starting 10 or 15 years ago. They actually stopped because they just didn't think they were making a dent. And they stopped about 5 years before the Chinese started drinking massive quantities of wine. So guess who didn't stop? Chile. Chilean wine is considered a premium wine that you should pay top dollar for. Well, that's preposterous. It's not even good. Sorry, Chile. But they branded the heck out of their region. New Zealand and Australian beef is considered premier top dollar beef. It's not good either. Sorry, Australia and New Zealand. But compared to American beef, it doesn't even taste right. But yet they went into China and branded the heck out of their countries and provinces and states. So the concept here is there something we could do? And we tried this like 15 years ago, calling it, I think, Brand Oregon at the time. And then they came up with a slogan, We Love Dreamers. Well, these slogans come and go, and many states have tried different ones, and some are horribly disastrous, and some are okay. Like Florida right now has, I think, Florida, the future is here. So they're trying to get high-tech and robotics and aeronautics people to think about locating there. I think Oregon has such intrinsic premium value in and of itself that you don't have to have a slogan. You just have to have the word Oregon and then use the word Oregon to tell the story about Oregon, the things that we are part of our character, rugged individualism, you know, lifestyle, sustainability, all the things that people here kind of have as part of our ethos. But it can't be mandatory. You can't force anybody to use it if they don't want to. The question is there a way to get something going where you could have a brand? Now, the certified part comes from some conversations with some pretty big business leaders in Oregon. One had one of the largest companies in Oregon, sold it, now has one of the premier up-and-coming destination resorts in eastern Oregon, 3,000 head of cattle, 2,000 herd of goats, all thinking about how to brand. One of his products was a golf course. It was in Forbes magazine yesterday as the top 9 up-and-coming golf courses in the United States to look for this next year. So he's more interested in not just branding his own ranch, but also branding the term Oregon. So we got into this conversation, and I think it was his lawyer said, well, what about using the word certified? Because certified implies something, at least. And the typical ag producer now is usually engaging in some kind of certification for market reasons. So on our orchard, we use Good Agricultural Practices, GAP. Our whole co-op actually has to be GAP certified, or you can't sell in Costco anymore and you can't sell in Europe anymore. So a lot of us have embraced certifications, not necessarily because we thought we were doing anything wrong, but because customers required them, otherwise you're not selling in our marketplace. So the use of the term certified has an implication that it actually means something, that somebody certified it. So to do that, you have to have somebody certify it. The question is, what are they certifying? And that's the core question at issue in this bill. I didn't try and put it in here. I think in past iterations, I put in here what it means. Typically, I don't know if they're here today, but you will find at least some people with I would call it conspiracy theory, but the concern that a voluntary certification would lead then to a mandatory certification. So even having voluntary certifications where people can do it is scary to some groups because they think eventually voluntary becomes mandatory. It's not certainly my intent. It can mean as simple as this. If it's made in Oregon by either an Oregon headquartered, let's say it this way. An Oregon headquartered company produces a product like Nike, wherever they produce it, but they're headquartered in Oregon, or a non-Oregon headquartered company produces more than 50.1% of the product. That could be certified Oregon, meaning it's either headquartered here or most of it's made here. Could be as simple as that. Could go further, but I feel like you got to get Oregonians involved in the conversation to what it would truly mean to put the term certified Oregon. The reason you would put it in statute, not just have people make their own, because if somebody who doesn't make, for example, in this case, they're not headquartered here and they make less than 50% in Oregon, becomes such a premium brand and they start putting Oregon on it, you have to be able to enforce on them and say, hey, you can't say that. You're not actually making your product in Oregon. So that's why I don't just go out and start a nonprofit and do this on my own. So anyway, that's my big wide brainstorm thinking out loud on where this all came from. Joel probably has a much more concise prepared testimony.
Well, that's great. I think that's really exciting. Let's have Joel give his remarks. And, you know, we have one more bill we're hoping to hear today with a couple of people who want to testify. So look forward to hearing your thoughts.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of Oregon Business Association and Associated Oregon Industries. I'll be really brief. We've been supportive of a program like, you know, this concept for a number of years. A lot of the stuff Representative Klim has cited, that he hasn't cited, mint in Oregon. We used to be a top grower of mint and commanded at a 20% premium just based on the quality of the mint that we grew here in Oregon. Oregon wine commands a premium over both Washington and California wine, again, you know, because there's something to the quality, the state land use laws that we have, the sustainability that goes into every product that's developed in this state. And so, yeah, we've been supportive of a certification where we can kind of leverage that perceived quality that there is and allow companies on a voluntary basis to apply for that certification and go advertise and command a premium.
Excellent. Rep Post and then Rep Brocksmith.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Here, I don't have a problem with this, even though I told you I was going to have
a
problem.
I know. I was waiting to get
But I have a question for you. So, I mean, this is an advisory group, which is a fancy name for a task force, work group, whatever you want to call it. And as you well know, we have lots of task forces around here that have been making the news lately. Here's my problem with this one, and it's my problem every time. And I hate to go partisan on you, but you are a nonpartisan guy, Representative Klim, and I trust that. And that's because I know you and I know where you are. To have the President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, and the Governor appoint these members bothers me. How about we do something different in this building and think outside the box and have the minority speaker or minority leader, the minority leader over there, and the governor, and have some bipartisanship. Even if they appoint a bipartisan committee, it's still being appointed by the same three people that appoint everything in this building. And I know you like to rock the world. Let's rock the world with this.
Yeah, I'm totally fine with that. You know, I wish it was a world where we didn't have to think in those terms, but you know what it is. So let's just acknowledge it. And I actually have talked to folks about this. I think in general, having poor Mike McClain have to pick will get all the scheduling nightmares and people mad because he didn't put him on the one. Get it to him. I think he would really appreciate that.
So we're going to go to Rep. Brocksmith, but I just want to note that since this isn't scheduled for a work session today, we have more opportunity to work on this and think it through. So it's great that we're getting started with this conversation and look forward to more conversations. Rep. Brocksmith.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Bill's Representative Post's comments, but I just want to tell you how much I appreciate the concept. So I spent 4 years in my former life as one of the directors for America's Wild Rivers Coast. How many in this room have ever heard of America's Wild Rivers Coast? Well, we didn't do a very good job. But that was a marketing DMO, similar to, you know, the Napa Valley is not just one city. So we've tried to brand Southwest Oregon on the coast, 101 miles of nature's best, America's Wild Rivers Coast. We've tried to brand Made in Curry County. I don't think that you can use Made in Oregon because I'm sure there's a copyright on that.
I meant to say that. Yeah. the NATO family might have us for lunch.
Right, but you have you know, Port Orford Sustainable Seafood, and so I think it's fantastic that the concept that, you know, certified Oregon, is a great market slogan and a way that we can push Oregon products out. You know, it's an easy way to, it's not, you're not forcing companies to do it. Mm. You're allowing them to enter into basically a program to come on board. They would have to pay for their own, you know, I mean, you would probably come up with a
logo or something.
But it would be at their cost to you know, put it on their printing and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's a win-win.
Excellent.
That's the hope.
Thank you very much, and we look forward to more conversations about this. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2041, open a public hearing on House Bill 2151. And Mr. Crawford, could you please describe that bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2151 allows a property tax exemption for newly acquired food processing machinery and equipment acquired by persons engaging in the business of producing cannabinoid edibles, alcoholic beverages, and alcoholic liquors. It takes effect on the 91st day following sine die.
All right. So we have, I'm not sure if there's anyone who wants to, Rep. Gomberg, would you like to give a description of this bill?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I was out in another room testifying on another bill. Are we at 2151?
We are at 2151, and I think we brought this in as a committee bill under the leadership of the Committee on Small Business Growth. So if you were inclined, you could give a few remarks, or we could move straight into community comment.
I'd be happy to go straight to community comments, Madam Chair. I'd just simply indicate that this was not one of a number of bills brought forward by the interim Special Committee on Small Business Growth, and the description here is straightforward. But if there is public testimony, I'd be happy to waive my time and give it back to the committee.
That's great. And again, it's not scheduled for a work session, but we do have three people who are signed up to offer comments. And so I'll invite them all up at the same time. We have Mark Garza, Department of Revenue, Jody Weiser, Tax Fairness Oregon, and Wendy Johnson, League of Cities. Welcome. We haven't left you much time, but we've left you a few minutes each. And since we're not doing a work session, if we were to move the bill forward, there would be more opportunities to weigh in, I'm sure.
Chair Leninger, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. House Bill 2151, as Mr. Crawford explained, is a property tax exemption extension. We already have an exemption for several other food products in that processing. So we already cover milk, grain products, bakery products, vegetables, fruits, those types of things. This would extend it and provide an exemption for cannabinoid edibles and alcoholic products. The League opposes this whole exemption and has since it started, not because we don't support the food and beverage industry. We do. We support those jobs. But this exemption does not have any sideboards at all. It just says because you produce this product, you get an exemption for the machinery and equipment. And so some of these are located already in enterprise zones that the community has a choice in whether they provide that exemption. But this exemption is just because you provide or you make this product, you get this exemption. And so there is no return on investment requirement. There is no job requirement. There's just no data. And cities are in the business of providing services. And so we have to provide those services no matter what to those businesses. And they are often costly services for water, sewer, police, and such. And so taking these products, these properties off the tax rolls for 5 years can be an expensive endeavor if there's no community support and or the infrastructure isn't existing. So just as a matter of policy, we prefer those exemptions that are a local choice. Many of these businesses are already existing, and so they need to replace the property anyway. And so in the Revenue Committee, we talk about but-for. Would the business have replaced the property anyway? We just don't have that assurance with this type of exemption. And so for those reasons, we oppose. And the dollars are not insignificant. Last session, the exemption was brought in to add the bakeries and the wheat processors. The revenue impact that was provided to the committee back then was that it would be about $800,000 for a biennium. But as you saw, there was posting the tax expenditure report. This exemption has doubled from a $3.4 million revenue impact loss to a $6 million. So it doubled from what we expected by just adding the milk and grain and bakery folks. So we're concerned about what type of revenue loss this would be by adding the cannabinoid and alcohol producers. These industries, as you saw from the presentation, are growing despite not having an exemption. So we just want to make sure that there's a good return on investment and just remind you that 40% of property tax dollars go to schools. So that's putting a further dent in that, not to mention the city share, which is usually about 20% of tax revenues. So I'll keep it short. Those are our concerns about it. We want to promote economic development. I think the presentation you heard earlier on what we can do with R&D is an important focus, but it shouldn't be on property tax to grow the food processing industry.
Okay, that is good input. I want to be clear that we're not looking to move the bill today, so, and I don't think we have anyone who's a proponent speaking to the bill, so you can kind of frame your remarks within that. Also, I just, in terms of timing, we are going to do a rule suspension so that at the end of your remarks, so we have about 2 minutes for each of the remaining speakers, so that we can get a vote for Rep. Marsh on the bill that we moved earlier. Who would like to go next?
Do you want to go?
Let's have Ms. Weiser go next.
Security Weiser, speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. Wendy said much of what I would say. You know, we used to tax all equipment, and we still tax a lot of equipment. But we've excluded over and over and over since the 90s pieces of equipment from being taxed. And yet, if you've got pipes in a field that you don't want stolen, you do expect police protection and courts to help protect you. If you've got a piece of equipment in the barn and the barn starts burning, you expect the fire department to come. And so it really doesn't make sense to keep reducing the revenue for local communities when they have to provide the services for the stuff that's being excluded. And these three industries are all having fabulous growth, and they're paying taxes on their equipment now. They've grown paying taxes. It seems like it's the time where you would add taxes, not decrease taxes. And
that's
so,
a different committee, but I believe they are trying to do that.
Yes. So it doesn't really make sense. And I would like to add one other thing. We did some analysis this summer. The ag industry in this state operates on 26% of the state's land and pays 2.8% of the state's property taxes. Our income taxes from the industry are about minus $5 million every year. In a good year, the losses from farming are about $150 million. And in a bad year, they're about $350 million. So we really do have to look at how deeply we subsidize an industry when, in fact, they don't pay taxes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Chair Langer, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. The department's neutral on the policy of exempting any kind of equipment for cannabis or alcohol, but what we would prefer is that it would be put into its own exemption rather than be shoehorned into the food processor's exemption. If you look through the food processor's exemption as it's written right now, there's language in there like primary processing, raw or fresh, prior to the first point of sale. And this language is going to make it hard for us to really understand how to treat certain equipment. You might have marijuana equipment used to extract something out of the plant, and then you might go ahead and turn around and have baking equipment. Are both of those meant to qualify or no? So those are just things that we would have to look at. If you did want to keep it in this food processor's exemption, we would really ask that it not be written the way that it's currently written, where it the word producing is added and it refers and it would basically affect all of the industries that are already in there. So that would be, you know, nuts, legumes, grains, bakery products, dairy products, eggs, seafood. There's a lot of case law already out there about, you know, what the food processor's exemption does and doesn't apply to. And to add producing in would possibly, arguably, have the effect of nullifying some of that case law. So money that we've spent on litigation would kind of be wasted. So we think that you could just as easily keep that definition for those old businesses as it is, and then just say, or producing cannabinoid edibles or alcoholic beverages or alcoholic liquor, get your result that you want and avoid upending any kind of case law that's out there. So.
Great. Thank you. Rep. Gomber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm cognizant of the time. I just wanted to say very quickly, again, this measure was brought forward by the Interim Committee on Small Business Growth. It was one of about a dozen different bills that were suggested during the course of our work. I'm surprised that the advocates that brought this concept to us aren't here today. I'd be happy as the former chair of that interim committee to track them down, get their response to some of these concerns, and see where we go from here.
Okay. Great. Thank you. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2151, and I'm going to ask Vice Chair Brock Smith for a motion to suspend rules so that we can reopen the work session on House Bill 2243.
Madam Chair, I move that we suspend the rules and open the work session on House Bill 2243.
Any objections? Seeing none, rules are suspended. We'll reopen a work session on House Bill 2243. And can I just ask Rep. Marsh, or do we need to have a motion for anything?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, rule suspension for the purpose of taking a vote that will not affect the outcome of that vote. With the rules currently being suspended, all you as the chair would otherwise need to do is ask Representative Marsh how she votes.
Representative Marsh, how do you vote?
Thank you, Co-Chair. Chair. I vote aye. May I make a comment for the record as
please
well?
Please do.
I do support the extension of the e-commerce zone tax benefits. I have grave concerns regarding the recommendation from Oregon Business that this tax credit be refundable. I think as evaluation of our entire tax credit system goes forward, I would encourage the next body that looks at this to look very carefully at that element of the bill.
Excellent. Thank you. I appreciate that comment. And with that, we're going to close the work session, House Bill 2243, and we are going to adjourn the meeting. Thanks, everybody. All right. Thanks, everybody.